Welcome to the Philacrosophy Podcast, where host and lacrosse expert Jamie Monroe will do what he does best, talk about lacrosse. Each episode will provide listeners with education, insights, stories, and lessons about the lacrosse world. We will discuss current events, coaching, philosophies, and college lacrosse recruiting. Now let's get started with your host, Jamie Monroe.
How's it going, everybody? Really excited to welcome back Jerry Byrne to the Philacrosophy Podcast. Jerry is the head coach at Harvard and has been a frequent guest on the show. And we love talking lacrosse, movies, movie quotes, concerts, pickleball, surfing, you name it. So what's up? What's up, Jerry? How you doing, man?
You know, I think we have to start with, if you're of a certain age, I am the Paul Simon of the Jamie Monroe podcast world. I've hosted Saturday Night Live. Paul Simon's hosted Saturday Night Live more than anybody, and I've been on the Jamie Monroe podcast more than anybody.
I think you have.
A few more spots, and I get a mug, and I become a co-host.
I love it. Bernsey, we didn't even really follow up, but how is the Sphere?
The Sphere, yes, that was went out and worked an event for Adrenaline out in Vegas, and Casey DeNolfo and I and Will Corrigan went to see U2 at the Sphere in, I don't know if that was October or must have been November, but it was I've now seen U2 in like four or five different decades now. And which means I saw him when I was in my, when I was 5 years old. And so it was great. It was not cheap, but
not cheap.
The music was tremendous. I'm a huge U2 fan, and neither Will nor Casey were, but I think the music, the sonic element was, they were really strong. Just the acoustics of the building was super interesting, combined with the 360-degree graphics and kind of total immersion. It was, if you're a U2 fan, it was kind of a bucket list thing. And if you weren't, I think it was kind of like the next level of immersion. It's like when you and I talk about going to an NBA, like if I went to see the Knicks in the 1970s, which I did when they were good, like they played the game, and it was just crowd noise. There was nothing. Maybe they had the organist, playing dun dun dun, mm-hmm. get the fans hyped up. This is the whole 180 degrees away from that. This is total visual and sonic immersion. And it was. I'm glad I did it. I'm glad I invested the money in doing it, and I would do it again.
Yeah, man. I thought it was pretty cool. I saw him a couple weeks before you, and you know, Jerry, he's probably not as good as the time you saw him at Nassau Coliseum, but.
yeah, I think I lost my jean jacket and my Velcro wallet from Ocean Pacific. I think I left it in section 4, seat 9D. So if you found it in 1980, please send it to my address here in Boston.
How about this? You two played at Brown Spring Weekend, 1983.
Yeah, that it was, back, and it's kind of circling back to that where, the artists are getting less and less money from Apple, and so they have to tour again. And so, to make their living, obviously to hone their craft, and they probably enjoy playing live, but back when they were all getting paid from CD sales and all that stuff, maybe they didn't have to tour as much. Now, your boy Matt Rowley and I and our wives went to see G Love and Special Sauce at a winery that's a half mile from my apartment in Boston that had, maybe it was 300 people. 30th anniversary of his album Philadelphonic for all the G Love and Special Sauce fans. But I think it's just a great time for music, and if you're our age, and or the artist is of our age, they're still out there doing it, because I think part of it is they love it, and part of it is they become accustomed to a certain kind of lifestyle that they're trying to maintain. So, yeah, but that's crazy to think, you know, seeing, I think you two played out at the Malibu, which is a beach. I call it a beach club, but it's that would be an offense to beach clubs. It's basically a cinder block building right on, right near Point Lookout on off Jones Beach. And, you know, they played there in like 1982 when I was in high school. So, yeah, it's amazing. Yeah. It's amazing. Crazy times, man. Those crazy times are coming back 40 years later.
Love it. All right, let's talk lacrosse for a little bit here. What's new, Jerry? I feel like I haven't talked lacrosse with you in a little while. What do you got that you're thinking about these days?
I think a lot of kind of what I'm thinking about is coming from, you know, our assistant coaches, Neil Hutchinson, who's our head assistant and offense coordinator, is, I would say he's a tinkerer, but he's an observer. Like, he's watching not just the games that we have to watch because of, you know, scouting. He's also watching, you know, every second of our practice and our drills. And so he's, you know, he's very thoughtful and insightful on, you know, how to improve. And same thing with Mike Terranova, who's our goalie and faceoff coach, who was our director of ops last year. He's doing the same thing. I my mindset, which is, all right, what are you doing and how do you develop drills to get better at it? What are you not good at? How do you develop drills, micro drills to get better at it? So we're kind of morphing that into the rest of our staff. And then Nick Rill, who is, he and I are partnering on defense and trying to, still stay kind of core to some of my principles, but at the same time, him bringing his Marquette experience, his Maryland experience, his Binghamton and Vermont experience to kind of, I wouldn't say it's creating a hybrid, but how do we take some of maybe the best things that I feel strongly about? How do we modify them? How do we integrate some of the things that he was taught and also playing in the PLL? So I think what's new is, how do you develop and evolve, and not so be stubborn around, we have to do it that way because I'm the head coach.
Yeah, I love it. So what are some things that you've evolved into doing? Not so much that you've bagged doing the other stuff, but what have you added?
I think Nick has done a great job of bringing, and same thing with Ted Bergman last year, who helped me on defense, is, how do you play picks? How do you play picks? How do you communicate through picks? How do you hedge? How do you chip? How do you jump? How do you be predictable and be really great in your footwork and your language, which also now gives you some flexibility, to do unpredictable things. So it's this kind of battle between embracing technique that's required to teach that becomes really sticky for your guys. But also, if you do that really well, it allows you to adapt and be instinctive and impulsive with your guys. So, in the past, I was obviously much more, rigid and we're doing it this way and shut your mouth and probably a little bit less so to that, because I think there's, Neil and Mike and Christian Thomas, who's our ops guy, who was a two-time captain and national champion at Merrimack, all those guys. Like, it's one of the great things about getting older is that you kind of know what you're good at, but you're open to embracing the fact that you're not good at stuff. And mm-hmm. And what can 30-year-olds bring to your worldview that if you were really narrow-minded, you wouldn't be able to evolve. So I think mostly kind of playing picks and some new language and, like Nick still plays in the PLL, for example. So he's, he's bringing, right, this is how we approach certain stuff. Here's how we practice one day a week and get ready for an opponent. How do you do film? How do you do drills? How do you prepare for a matchup and things like that? So all stuff that, I've never really had to worry about in right. recent memory. So it opens up new pathways and synapses in the brain if you can kind of start thinking about stuff in a different way.
Yeah, so traditionally you were more of a play the ball as if there was not a pick there.
Right.
ball pressure, get over it. If you run into the pick, switch with maybe the occasional, if you're really deep and you see it, maybe you'll go under, but you didn't used to love going under picks because of the head turn element of things. But obviously sometimes when you're that far out, it just makes more sense to take a shortcut. But now this, the element of the hedge and the whack to try to give the ball carrier something more to think about and buy time to being able to get back is something that you've been experimenting with and liking a little bit.
Yeah. And it takes, you know, it's like anything else, it takes a lot of practice. And not surprisingly, you know, you heard, a couple of games this weekend where announcers were, kind of vilifying some of the defenses. The reality is that, it's a big field. The offensive players are super skilled. There's probably, 1,000 Instagram and YouTube channels dedicated to offensive shooting, dodging, and small sided play, and probably less than 100 on the defensive side. So offense, at least tends to track maybe generally better, niftier, quicker, fast twitch athletes. And if they have some of the advantage of all these resources and there's not maybe not as much dedication and investment going on defensively in that same realm, it falls on the college coaches to develop that in their players. So Nick Grill has done a great job in kind of instituting that. Ted Bergman last year and Nick this year, like, all right, how do we, understand when a guy's running into a pick, because you still need to be able to make switch and get through decisions. But how do you do the drop step? How do you do the stick wave? How do you chip? How do you stack and whack, whatever you call it, to do that in a way that maybe a little less about keeping matchups and more about, ball pressure and make it more difficult for offenses to get what they want. And because I think there's an element of offenses out there, whether it's set plays or like, hey, we're these are the things. If we do A and B, C and D should come out. And so they're honing in on C and D. And so if you can kind of discern that, then you're going to make it difficult for them to get to C and D. And so I think all of that kind of has led me to the point that we're at now.
Yeah. What do you think? What do you think the hedge and whack does to the offense that makes it harder for them at times?
I think the battle within the battle is often, and you're a basketball fan, so you know this. I think the angle of the start of the carry is so critical. The more east-west it is or non-threatening, then everything else becomes easy after that. So I think that's super critical. And I think doing that well is often predicated by the work that the guy's doing 10 seconds before the two-man happen, right? So whenever an athlete comes into me, coach, I want to watch this clip together. And I'm like, all right, what time is it? Oh, he's like, that's 1:45 left in the whatever. I always go back to like 2 minutes because I want to see what's the backstory on this thing that you had questions about or struggle with. What I mean? So I think for offenses to do it well, it's how are you preparing yourself athletically and geographically on the field to make it difficult for a defense to play that well. Conversely, the guy who's coming in and trying to make the read on, is it a traditional pick? Is it a swing pick? Is it a bee sting? Is it a flyby? Whatever it is, the better that guy sets it up, the more difficult it is for the off-ball guy to make the communication and the decision. So that's one kind of battle.
Yeah.
That's, the footwork and the preparation and the sell, the sell with the guy with the ball and the sell
Guy with the ball, man, is just such an important and I'd say underrated part that I keep watching. No sell. Project your direction. They're going to have no problem
defending. Right. But sometimes that sell, the flip argument of what I was saying was, is there ball pressure? Is the guy making the approach on the ball coming from a long distance himself because of what the other four guys were doing offensively. So there's like this domino effect of what, you know, this existential battle between good offense and good defense is often what happened 10 to 15 seconds earlier away from, you know, where the ball is going to end up. And then what footwork and preparation and geography have you taken as a, you know, the guy who now has the ball and his partnership with the guy who may do some, you know, two-man type stuff. So it's that. And then defensively, your approach, your stance, your awareness, your ability to listen, you know, how hard you're working off ball, and how hard you're working off ball may be a function of how good the rest of the offense has been for your opponent. So all, like, it's rare. Like, I guess my point is, it's rarely just those four people. Mm-hmm. There's some iterations, like tree rings away from where the ball got to. And the better that is, and the smarter you are with your space and how harder you work on offense, you're probably going to have something positive come out. Conversely, if you don't and the defense works really hard, they're going to win that kind of game within the game. So just like, you know, I think about drills that way. I think about the game that way. What's the action within the action that they're trying to create? But also, what can you do prior to that that makes it hard for the offense or the defense? Love I know it sounds great. That sounds like you and I are both coming from the Grateful Dead concert in 1979, but it's, you know, there is an element of that your players, to think the game, they need to understand action within action.
One thing you mentioned a couple times was sort of having to do with like drill construction, coming up with drills that will teach the situations that you want. I think that could be a really interesting topic to dive into. How do you think about that? How do you construct drills based on situations? And then maybe you can give us an example of something you've constructed recently that was an example of how you went about doing that. There's so many like, podcasts that they'd probably love to dive into your thought process.
I mean, I think like anything else, like any coach, you're usually something bad happened in a practice or a game, yeah, or you're preparing for an opponent that has certain, you know, things. Like we all have things that we like love to do as coaches and love to do in game prep and things like that. So we all have kind of indicators, you know, and so part of it is, all right, do you understand what they're trying to do? But also then, well, if they understand what they're trying to do and they presume that you're going to understand what they're going to try to do, what's the, you know, how do you continue to flip that on its ear and be less predictable and things like that? But I think a lot of the drills come from you got exposed in something, you know? So whether it's, you know, a jump cut or a flyby or, you know, not playing inside picks off ball well, or, you know, you keep on getting pinned in on a mumbo on the weak side of the field. Or so often it comes from you didn't do something well. And you know that other coaches are really good at it. And if they identify that there's three or five things that they struggle with, let's work on that. So you're presuming that your future opponent is going to work on something. So you want to kind of stick your finger in that you want to plug that hole, so to speak, and put some tape over it for now and then try to plug it later. But it stems from getting exposed and not doing something well. So, you know, 10 years ago, it might've been, you know, everybody's doing a 40 mumbo and deciding how you want to slide and how you, like some teams want, you know, how do you stay with you? If you're a team that wants to stay with their matchups, how do you stay with your matchups, but still have respect for the dodge? Or if you're someone who might pass and shed guys and outside guy goes to the inside guy and inside guy goes to the outside guy. So it all stems from that. You're watching film. You're like, oh, someone's going to pick up on that. Let's, you know, like, so one of the things that I think a lot of teams, as an example, is, you know, when you and I were younger, you dodge, throw it through X, throw it to, you know, like, you know, kind of dodge, throw stuff. And people still do that. It's not, but I think what a lot of teams are often also doing is taking advantage of a slide and recovery and bringing the ball right back to where the ball just was. So instead of like anticipating this throw through the top or throw through X, and you know, as the ball's in the air, you have all this time to recover. And so it makes it less scary for a defense. But if you know that they're panicked in their recovery defensively, you bring the ball right back up. So if you were doing two man in an alley and the ball gets pushed through to X, you might fire the ball right back to the dodge side, you know? And so, which is a little bit counterintuitive. So just stuff like that. Like how do you recover and then make another difficult approach? Where in the past it might be, oh, you got slid to, recover to the crease, bump you out to the backside, and now you're on the ball again. That was difficult and still is. Mm-hmm. But what if you got slid to, recovered, and now the guy had to make a U-turn back out to the ball because it came right back out? That's right. A little bit different, you know? So, and again, offensive coaches are really good. So things like that are insightful and help you kind of build like 3 and 4 and 5 person drills that can really help kind of develop poise in your players.
So when you're developing these drills, I know, you know, there's been a tendency for you to do defense versus defense while the offense is working on the other end. And it's allowed you to just really crank out a ton of different drills. I was always kind of blown away by how many different drills that you would do. But I was also really interested in the way that they, even though they weren't totally live, because you weren't going to have your defensemen beating the crap out of each other and they were all handling with poles, but it was live enough that there were decisions to be made. And I always found it interesting that A, you would whip through, you know, like literally like 7 drills in 18 minutes. But also that there was just decisions and communication. And it was almost like the offensive players were working with the defensive players to give and provide the look that you wanted them to learn, the read for the decision-making process. I wanted to see if you could chat a little bit about that.
I love that. It's one of my favorite parts of coaching is, you know, basically trying to kind of give these little vignettes, these little tidbits to your players, particularly as your game planning going into a week, is you can do 7 drills in 18 minutes only if the drills are really simple and you've been hopefully doing them for some element of time where 3/4 of your players are really experienced in setting them up. Yeah. And if they're experienced in setting them up, it means they know all the coaching points. And so they can educate the younger players. So you constantly get this kind of circular education going on. So even though you're bringing new players in every year, you have 3/4 of your players have the basic tenets of the drill and the teaching. And so that's the motivation. The other part of the motivation is you're de-stressing them, the pressure points that they're going to see from a future opponent. They're practicing language. They're getting some of their stick handling in instead of doing a traditional dull defensive stick handling drill. They're doing stick handling, but playing the roles of offensive players. So another unintended benefit is that they are playing the role of an offensive player. So they're going to develop this empathy and offensive insight that only an offensive player could have to that level of depth. So all of those things are beneficial. And it also limits the coach from talking too much. If you have a 20-minute segment and you're trying to get through 7 drills in 18 or 20 minutes with some coaching involved, it's a fast way to keep the energy and the language going. So it has a language component, has an IQ component, has an offensive empathy component, and it has a live enough component that it reflects the game, and which I think drills have to reflect the game. If they don't, I don't think they're a great drill. And then you can customize those things to the opponent that you play. So it now has this other iteration where once you get into your season, you can take this library of drills and modify them to the specificity of an opponent, whether it's the way they dodge or they have a lot of Canadians, they do a lot of two-man, they interfere, they do a lot of sweeps. You know what I mean? Like, you can really start tweaking it in a way that really, like, de-stresses your guys so that when they get to the game, they feel like they've already played it in its smallest components.
So you said a second ago, if it doesn't reflect the game, it's not a great drill, something along those lines. Would you say that decision-making is one of the most important reflections of the game?
You know, I think that like coaching IQ, it sounds much easier than it actually is. People who think the game, you know, so we're, you know, because of the Ivy League season, we don't get to spend as much time on, you know, riding and clearing and all the things that some of your opponents are going to do. And so that when we finally get to some reps where we can work on some of these specialty situations, like the guys who can think the game and process it even before they come on the field or process it while they're on the field, they stand out like, you know, like a fart in church. You know, they're just like, you just see it, you know, they're just thinking the game on a whole other level versus maybe some other players that are more like chess pieces. You got to move them around, you know, versus someone who can just think it. So that's a hard thing. Like, you want to recruit that for sure. You know, and if you can't, if they don't have a high level of IQ, you hopefully there's someone who can, you know, think on their feet and things like that. And so some of those things you don't learn until they get here. So, but like thinking the game is such a valuable, because it makes you faster. Just like someone who can't think the game, who's an elite athlete, and you get them out there processing, they look like a slug out there versus the guy, you know, it's like a great crease offensive player. He's often not the best vertically or laterally, but they know how to get open. Same thing with like a tight end or something, you know, notwithstanding Gronkowski, but like, you know, a guy who just knows how to get open versus a guy who could probably run and get to an open spot, but might run past it. He just didn't realize he was open. Mm-hmm. You know, it's kind of like that conundrum. So, you know, but you use film, you use peer-to-peer teaching, you use drills to try to get your guys to develop faster than you would like.
Love it. All right. So what are some of the things offensively that Hutch is bringing to the table that is making you think and is making you interested? And is any of the sort of the different two-man stuff defensively impacting your opinions on how you want to play offense? I know you haven't been a huge on two-man game in the past. Is that something that you're thinking more about now?
Yeah, you know, I think that, like, and you know this, the more it just happens in run of play, it doesn't seem like almost, it seems less like a philosophy and more just like good offense. Mm-hmm. You know, so I think the things that he's been super focused on is, you know, like one of the terms that I use is like runway. Like, what are you doing one or two passes away so that when you get the ball thrown to you, you've already done the work to prepare, to get it and do what's really obvious to do. You know what I mean? So this concept of runwaying requires, you know, a really competitive mindset. It requires spatial awareness, requires footwork that doesn't involve backpedaling, that you're sideways running, or you're moving like an athlete who's ready to catch this ball and has basically already started his dodge. And if you're doing, the other four or five offensive players are playing good offense, that guy now catches the ball, and he can, and because he's athletic, he can probably catch an imperfect pass, because not all the transfer passes are going to be right on your ear. So that preparation, I think he's done a really good job of working on, because that's the kind of the battle in the game. That's the the battle of good versus evil, depending on how you want to look at it. It's like, I'm catching the ball at 16, prepared, my body, I call it the sprinter's pose. Like, I got my foot back, I'm ready to adjust to a pass that might be across my body, whatever. But I'm in the sprinter's pose and I'm ready to push off and go. The more imperfect the transfer pass is because of maybe defensive disruption or just bad pass, like I think a bad pass is worth 2 yards in benefit to a defense, 2 yards in approach. So if I do everything right in my runway, I'm catching the ball at 17, I'm sprinter's pose, I'm ready to go. If that's a 6 or 7 yard approach, that's going to be good for the offense, right? But if I can disrupt, maybe I make it an imperfect pass, maybe it's a 4.5 yard approach. So I really think that footwork and organization and passing cleanliness and passing speed is really the game within the game of offense versus defense. And then all the ripple effects of off-ball preparation offensively and defensively. Who's winning those games? Everyone wants to focus on the hammer, on the run, or the step down, but like, who wins those games? The one I just described really determines who wins the game.
So to be clear,
so I think he's worked a lot on spacing and passing and pushing the ball forward, rolling back, all the things, all the footwork and handwork stuff you have to do that well, which I think is going to allow us to play really good offense this year.
Back to this runway concept. Basically, is it kind of like the drift that we see going on with various teams where you're kind of drifting, but you're turning your drift into a essentially starting your dodge before you get the ball so you can catch it in stride and have a advantage that you wouldn't have had if you waited to catch it and gave the defender a more normal approach to a standstill?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a lot of the stuff that high school guys have to adapt to that, if you're one of the best guys in your team, which is if you're playing at our level, you are, you don't catch it and like back up and circle up, make sure everyone sees you in the stands and everybody's prepared. You're like, you want to get it, whether it's a drift or a fade or a pop behind the ball. Like, it's almost like preparing yourself that transfer passes are not going to be clean and right on your ear every time. If it is, tremendous. But you need to prepare your body that you can handle every pass across your body. Is it low? Is it high? And the only way you do that is practice the discipline of the footwork and the choreography that you need to do to play good off-ball offense. And so, yeah, you used a very specific example, but it could be for anything. Like, how often do you see, a pop behind the ball and a throwback that's thrown over the guy's head, thrown at his ankle? So partly that could be the defense, partly it could be the handwork of the passer. But I think lots of times it's the unprepared nature of the guy. He wants to easy path. He wants the shortcut. He wants it to not be. He wants it to be perfect. And when it's not, that serves the defense. And so if defensively, like either disruption of the pass or the backside, release to jump that throwback, if you have a little disruption and really good footwork from the defense, we can survive the perfect pass. If it's an imperfect pass, not only are you not catching it, it's probably a turnover and the ball is going the other way. And because the pop was moving toward the midline, it could be a fast break. So all that stuff that the action within the action, I think, is really, it's the way I think about the game. It's the way it drives the drills that we develop. And it's the yin and yang of the game within the game that, if you can be good at it on offense and defense, you have a chance to be really good.
What's your take on using speed and drawing slides to get the defense rotating, like the dominoes theory that's talked about in basketball a lot? Once you get a slide going, you got dominoes falling. And if you make quick decisions of shoot, dodge, or pass, you can create more offense. in more offense, meaning, you know, maybe you attack another closeout or something like that. And in basketball, especially because of the ability to shoot threes, you can just pull up and shoot. And as soon as you got dominoes, you should be able to get a shot. I feel like in lacrosse, there's no question that the dominoes theory is relevant, but I sometimes feel like a good defense that is on time with their rotations and their dominoes can recover and catch right back up and get back to neutral, which has always led me to trying to figure out a balance between generating offense through creating dominoes. So maybe you attack and approach later versus don't allow the dominoes to be on time. Because if you make the first domino late, then the second domino is late and it can really put the defense in a tough spot. What are your thoughts on that from a offensive?
Yeah, sometimes fastball movement creates being late, you know, just because of the distance that slide and recovery has to. So sometimes that is the answer, you know, that you move the ball faster, then they can wheel around and recover and cover the most dangerous guys. And now, like, that 7-yard approach on the backside is really scary. Mm-hmm. And then now it becomes, are you prepared defensively? Are you prepared to help that guy? And then it becomes this, is your diligence around sliding and recovering and closing out, knowing that you could get beat in multiple directions, which is what happens when you have a 7-yard approach. It's like a giving up a skip pass. You're going to need help. And so now the game becomes, is the defense more prepared to do the things that need to be done, whether it's exiting above GLE and not worrying about a guy who's below GLE at X and play 6-on-5 above? Is it, you know, collapsing the crease and making them throw a really aggressive skip pass? Or is the offense outworking and getting to better space than the defense? And so, you know, so sometimes speed of ball movement is the answer. But I know, you know, you've talked a lot about deception and multi-move dodging and rockers and stepaways and, you know, pumps and pump fakes. And obviously when you were at Denver and the evolution that came from that, Americans playing like Canadians, and it started to come, and it's still very prevalent, is, you know, how do you maintain ball pressure? So sometimes like a hostage dribble in basketball where I kind of get past you, but I don't burst into the key because I'm worried about that 7-footer jumping me, but I slow down the dribble. Steph Curry is great at it, right? The way he toys with, you know, help is, you know, the question becomes, what is the easiest thing for your guys to learn? Or what guys showed up with some sort of acumen? Some guys are just one move and go guys. They're not good rollback guys. They're not good throwback guys. So run by someone, draw some help, and push the ball. That might just be his lot in life. Other guys who may have had, you know, become, you know, had to develop some sort of deception in their game, you know, they might be able to be a little bit slower and delay the dominoes from falling. You know, so I think it varies by opponent and by the skill set of your players.
Yeah, for sure. And I think that there's not, my whole point on this question was, there's nothing wrong, like you said, with, I mean, you know, it's always going to be true that if you can beat the defense with ball movement and make them start rotating around, that you're eventually going to wear them down. But even in those cases, eventually, if you don't do something unpredictable, you know, the defense is going to probably do their job. And that's part of it. It's just that the defense, any good defense, they literally defend everything you do. And the best defensive players are great anticipators. So learning how to throw them off with any type of deception has got to be an advantage, because if you're not being deceptive, it's kind of like back to the point you made on the pick actions, when if you're going to use a pick and you just kind of project where you're going, it's easy to guard. You watch a guy like Ryder Guernsey, how does he do it? He does it all with deception.
No doubt.
Everything he does is with deception. He gets people to check him, you know, prematurely so we can get a shot off. He looks off where he's going. And I feel like mixing that into all tempos of the game is basically what I'm interested in.
Yeah, no, and it's like an acquired taste, you know. It's like, you know, what is your skill, body of skill that you have in your team, and who can do it? Can, you know, versus being like monolithic, like I want everyone to do this. Well, not everybody can do everything, you know. So I think you have to play to your team strengths and your players' skill set, particularly when we're getting these guys when they're 18 and 19, and you know, hammering some skill into their brainstem may not, you know, may make us feel good that we have everybody doing it, but we may not be good at it.
Yeah, so, I agree. And hammering it in there doesn't even work anyways, because even if they can do it, just because they will do it. But that's kind of why I've been thinking a little bit more globally and big picture on just deception in general. Like look off where you're going. You know?
No doubt. You know, and not like look away, pass. It's just like
not just that. Yeah. Just like just generally don't project what you're doing.
Yeah, it's like a quarterback who, you know, whether it throws a guy open or gets the defensive backs, you know, because of what his hips do, or his lead foot is pointed, and then he drop steps and throws it into a different seam. It's the exact same.
You kind of have to do that. Also, it's interesting too, because you talk all the time defensively about how much you hate like the lead wrap, right? Yeah. Probably we haven't updated on that topic in a while, but I'm guessing it's still an issue. Which for everybody, basically a righty is guarding a lefty and he gives him a whack as he's dodging, and all of a sudden you're just pretty much beat, right?
I mean, you look at Ryder, and you know, love Ryder, obviously coached and recruited Ryder. You know, Ryder's not going to win any 5-10-5 or, you know, 40-yard, you know, sprint, but that guy gets by all the best defensemen in the world because of his, you know, he's got really strong legs, got a strong base, but he uses the mistakes. His sensory feel for pressure combined with the aggressive indicators that defensemen make, he, you know, that becomes like an algorithm, a calculus for him of why he gets to the front or gets to the middle, like consistently. And so, you know, it's kind of like the guy, you know, the guy who's always throwing haymakers in the boxing ring. Every once in a while, he lays some guy out and everyone's like, oh my God. But more often than that, guy is opening himself up to get some other, maybe not as big or better boxer, just housing him. Right. And so Ryder uses guys throwing haymakers to lay them on the canvas.
I've been thinking a lot about Ryder and thinking about that scenario, because when you're like dodging somebody and you're just going hard right at them, you're going to usually get their best effort. You're going to get all of the discipline that they've learned. But when all of a sudden you can bait them into like what you just said a second ago of making a mistake where they just go for some kind of a whack or anything because they start feeling that you're not really going at them, and you start pulling them out, and all of a sudden you're baiting them into checks. It's such an interesting concept to think about, that you can bait people into mistakes. And it's like, that's basically what Ryder does. He essentially baits you into mistakes. He baits you into checks before most people try to get a shot off and they have to shoot through a check. Ryder seems to bait a check as he's coming up the hash. And then once you're done checking, his hands are free to shoot it.
Well, you know, I think people confuse slashing with ball pressure. And again, if Ryder was going to get a shot off in either scenario, would you like it to happen in 3 seconds or 12 seconds? You know, like, you want to make it hard for the guy to get what he wants. And it doesn't mean you can always prevent a good player from getting what they want, but you don't want to do things that make it easier for him to get what he wants. And I think that he's a master of that. And there's a lot of really good players in college lacrosse and in the PLL who do that as well. And I always looked at as a big wind up lead wrap where you're slashing a guy as like a high school check, because it scares guys in high school and it doesn't scare really good players. And that's who you're preparing to play anyway. But also, I felt like, you know, I'm a righty, so, you know, big wind up, your weight shifts, you open up that space, obviously. And what really good players do is they run into that check to blunt it.
Yeah.
And when they blunt it, your hands are pinned against your body. We call this getting alligators. Mm-hmm. When you're like this, and again, Ryder is a really good athlete, but not gigantic and not a guy who's, you know, eating 45-pound plates for breakfast, is that Ryder now owns you. You're pinned like an alligator, and there's nothing you can do about it now. But you did get that really big, aggressive whack that everyone was like, oh, my God. Ryder wants that.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because that allows him to get in on a guy's body, and then he's walking the dog or getting to the middle, and or you're chasing the head of a stick. And you know what I mean? So I'm sorry, Ryder, if I blew up your spot, but I saw it enough in practice. I yelled at a defenseman who needed to learn that lesson from you.
I love watching that guy play. All right, let's talk a little. I want to talk a little man up. That's a topic we've never.
Man up, let's go.
Obviously, in man up play, you already have an advantage. It's 6-on-5. But sometimes I feel like it doesn't seem like it with so many with these man downs that seem to be able to make it just rotate. What do you think the biggest keys to EMO are?
Like to be a good extra man?
Great man up team against a really good man down team. What are some of the things you think that make it really, really challenging? What are some of the most important things about man up, would you say?
You know, I think the variety of players that you have, you know, every team wants a couple outside shooters, some good pipe finishers, you know, really good inside guys that you're confident in putting the ball into. That, you know, having a really good inside guy creates a lot of drama, you know, just because, and if they can move well, you know, again, these are all ifs. If they move well and sense, you know, do you sprint in an open area or do you casually kind of float into it and then burst into it? Obviously, if those guys have 10 to 12 yard range, that's always a bonus for your inside guy. And if they have both hands. So a guy, you know, you think about the really good inside guys like over the last 10 years, like Dylan Donahue and, you know, Mikey Wynn was really good. Kid Austin Madronic, who played for me here at Harvard. Like guys who just like a tight end, they just know how to get open and they catch everything. So I think inside guys, super value. Spacing and the ability to catch and do everything, you know, and because guys who don't have great footwork, they get nuggeted all the time. And then they're not an extra man. Because that's what the defense is like, hey, we're going to give up one or two shots. Let's make only one be a great shot. Offense is like, hey, let's not settle. If we do this well, we might not only need one great shot, which is touches on the point I think you were inferring is, why are we not shooting more? Why are we so passive? Why are we only hunting one great shot when you have a 30-second advantage or a 60-second advantage? I think you were kind of inferring that. But I think, you know, multi-hand guys, good space and good footwork to you know, fill lanes and follow, you know, guys who can shot show and priest feed or shot show and skip, you know, that's the really good teams have all those guys who can do a little bit of all those things. And the ability to skip and handle difficult skips through a bunch of sticks. You know, I think the really good extra mans do a lot of skeleton, but also they do a lot of live, you know, and they mix up their shapes and they don't do a lot of nowhere carries where they run to, you know, not being a threat. So I think the really good offenses have a bunch of those elements and they're not that complex, you know, but can also be surprising, whether it's a hidden ball or a, you know, a, pump and spin or a seal slips, like all the stuff that's, pretty prevalent and that everybody does, but they do them because they work, even though you may know it's coming.
Yeah. I love the concept of getting it inside. How much do you think about getting it in and kicking it out like a wall pass?
Yeah, no, I think that's, I think that's obviously become pretty common. I think it was much more organic, and now I think it's like a scripted thing. So the less real it feels, the less effect it has, if you get my drift. So I think it's happening more now because it's kind of cool versus doing it for kind of strategic reasons.
Well, if it gets in there, the defense has to collapse.
Yep, no doubt, no doubt. But yeah, I think a lot, the comes back to the skeleton practice that a lot of teams do. Yeah, that and you're coming in with so much more scouts, and you're like, all right, they're gonna support with this guy. So when we wall it in, let's push it out to that guy, not just that guy where it came from. Let's push it to a different place on the perimeter.
Wait, what do you mean by that?
Like, I think it's happening. Like, you're pushing it in from an outside, maybe a top-down look, and it comes back out to another top guy versus pushing it in and then pushing it wide, or pushing it, catching it, curling and moving it low. Like, it doesn't always have to, like, yes, when you think of wall, it's coming right back at
Right,
you.
right,
I
right,
think
right. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
about wall. I think about wall passes and
Yeah.
two passes, not,
I got you. Yeah.
you know what I mean?
Clearly, if the top center guy kick and you kick it out to the top to the lefty, it's going to be more dangerous than if you kicked it right out to the top center guy. If you got it down to a low guy, it'd be massive. I don't know. My take on it is I feel like this should be done even more. Every single time you get the ball inside to somebody and they kick it out, you generally are getting a good shot.
Like Will Ferrell, semi-pro. Kick it in, back out.
It's easier said than done to get it in there. But
If
if you can
you
get
had
it,
my first movie reference 35 minutes in, you've no one saw that coming.
that was pretty good. All right, man. So who do you guys open up with? Friartown
We got
Saturday?
Providence, the Fighting Bobby Bensons on Saturday here, Jordan Field. Beautiful CBG, Cambridge, Massachusetts. And yeah, no, we're excited. We have a home and home with them. So we'll go to Providence next year. I expect you to be hosting the tailgate this year. But we got a great schedule. We got because it's the Ivy League, we got five games in the first 2 weeks, Jamie.
There you go.
Just getting after it. And so we got a couple of really good home games, and then we got Virginia and Princeton and Dartmouth and Brown here, which is awesome. And we got great crowds here. So yeah, all good stuff. So hopefully you make it up for one of the tilts.
I hope so too, man. I get back to Boston pretty much once a month for some of the lax training I got going on, so I'll check in.
You're not calling me up to send a limo for you down to Rhode Island. You don't let me know. I live in the North End, man. We come and get a great meal.
Next time, next week,
Treat you to my favorite
I'll get
spot. You're supposed to know that's where my favorite spot is.
busted. GVD,
Neptune.
appreciate you coming on the show, man. As usual, always enjoy talking lax. Can't wait to watch the Crimson play. Fired up.
Peace out.